This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Kim Malcolm. Amazon is about to become a landlord to homeless families. The online retail giant will team up with local nonprofit Mary's Place to turn a vacant South Lake Union building into a homeless shelter. There's room for about 60 or 70 families. They'll start moving in on Monday. Amazon is not famous for hometown philanthropy or philanthropy in general. Seattle Times Amazon reporter Angel Gonzalez broke the story. I asked him, Amazon homeless shelter, what's going on?
Well, yeah, it seems Amazon is coming out of its shell. You know, it's a company that traditionally has not been known for philanthropy and for going out at beyond its, you know, its balance sheet and its conquest of the world in many ways. And you know, it seems they're using some of the real estate they have while they figure out what to do with it to house, you know, homeless people.
You know, Amazon had a lot of questions directed towards it in the last year about its role in the community, particularly after that New York Times story. Are you seeing some echoes of that here?
Well, yes, I think so. Part of it is that. Part of it is the fact that Amazon is growing so much that the growth is bringing along some sort of change in the corporate culture, too. You know, at the national level, it's realizing, you know, it needs to make a better case about its impact in terms of jobs and in terms of, like, social impact in order to advance its interests, right? It's a company that's not being very well understood, and so far they have been proud of that, but I think that's changing. As they become bigger, they grow under more scrutiny. And in Seattle, you know, that impact is maximized because they are probably one of the bigger reasons for the economic transformation of the city. So they know all eyes are on them, and you know, they probably are seeing the need to be seen as good neighbors.
So how did this partnership with Mary's Place happen?
Well, it's I think it's modeled after something the city of Seattle did. The city of Seattle, they had a building, it uses the site of a former bank that they are turning into a police precinct in North Seattle, and they allowed Mary's Place to hang in there for a year and set up a homeless shelter. And Amazon had a long relationship with Mary's Place. I guess, you know, they were thinking of things they could do, and they, you know, they saw the empty real estate they had. They have a couple of former motels, and, you know, they asked the city if, you know, those were suitable for that purpose, for creating a temporary homeless shelter. And once they got the approval from the city, they went to Mary's Place, which is a nonprofit Amazon has long been involved with. And they sort of set it up. And it took 4 months from, you know, conception to implementation, which is pretty quick.
Pretty quick turnaround, yeah. So what will life be like for the families who live there?
Well, it used to be a former dorm for Cornish College of the Arts students, so should be okay, right? I mean, there's families will have their own rooms. There's about 70 rooms. They're expecting between 60 and 70 families. There are going to be kids' playrooms and common rooms and a kitchen, from what I was told. I haven't seen the inside of the building myself. I understand the Fairmont Olympic Hotels was donating some furniture and bedding and furnishings for some of the rooms. So that would make at least those rooms pretty fancy, I would think. But, you know, but people are going to be there from 5 p.m. to 8 a.m. every day, and on weekends, you know, they get to hang out there for 24 hours, right? What the executive director of Mary's Place was telling me, her quote was like, you know, so kids can be in their jammies during the weekend, which is sort of a respite from life on the street.
Well, and this shelter is temporary. It is open for just a year. At least that's what the plan is right now. What happens after that?
Well, you know, Amazon couldn't promise anything. But at the same time, they said they have another former motel that at some point they're going to build on. But they have not taken possession of that. So they kind of really know the exact timing and of what they can do with the building and what they can't do. But they say their goal is to, if everything works out well, perhaps create another shelter there once this one closes.
Now, this is a vacant Amazon property. It's waiting to be developed. Mary's Place is going to pay the utilities. So that kind of leads to the question, just how much is Amazon giving back, really?
Well, you know, it's a good question. Like, you know, it shouldn't be treated as if they were creating, you know, like another Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, right? I mean, it's not costing them much money in relative terms, especially compared to their size. But, you know, at the same time, they're bringing a lot of people into their literal home, which is, you know, South Lake Union downtown. It's like they're going to be in close proximity with their executives, with their employees. I think there's more than symbolic value to that. And at the same time, you know, it's sort of a typical Amazon thing. You know, something that's cheap but effective, right? I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, yeah, Amazon is not spending $1 billion to solve homelessness, but a couple hundred people, including kids, are going to have someplace warm, you know, to sleep in a pretty convenient part of town.
Seattle Times Amazon reporter Angel Gonzalez. Amazon declined to comment for this story, but they did put out a statement saying, as we grow in Seattle, we recognize the importance of investing in our hometown in ways that benefit our neighbors and our employees. And in a more typical philanthropic move for the company, they linked to an Amazon Smile page where people who want to help can buy things like diapers and socks for the families at Mary's Place. We're tweeting out that link right now. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray wasn't surprised by today's announcement. After he declared a state of emergency about homelessness late last year, Amazon approached him. Amazon has been working with Mary's Place on the shelter proposal ever since. Mayor Murray said this issue is going to take a lot of hands to help solve.
You know, the growing crisis of homelessness in cities up and down the West Coast, big and small, is going to take public money, it's going to take nonprofits, and it's going to take the private sector. And, you know, once again, we're seeing a company like Amazon, as we've seen PEMCO and Vulcan, step up to provide space for temporary shelter for a really good program with great success, Mary's Place.
Would you have guessed that Amazon would be a pioneering local business in creating some shelter space?
Well, I'm pleased. I try not to guess in my job, so I am pleased because there's a lot of places that Amazon could choose to participate as a good citizen, and choosing to participate in probably the most difficult crisis and somewhat controversial crisis that we're involved in related to homelessness is pretty impressive on their part.
Is this an example then that you're going to try to push for, to have a greater cooperation between some of our biggest corporate citizens and the nonprofit world to deal with this issue?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of several things that we're working on. You know, we've pushed the federal government, and the president has put in his budget significant new funds for homelessness. We need more help from the private sector. And as you know, the city now is number three in the nation with the county and what we spend on homeless funding. And so it's really going to take the private sector and nonprofits to partner with us.
If you could swing for the fences, what else would you like to see coming from the business community?
Often in this city, we're having a discussion about the wrong part of the system. We have a lot of arguments around encampments, authorized or unauthorized, or around shelters. And it's actually programs like Mary's Place, a program called Diversion that Neighborhood House runs. It actually helps stabilize people, get them jobs, and get them into housing. And any private money that can go into those organizations will do far more for housing than anything else, and homelessness than anything else we face. So that's where I would, again, try and focus all of us, is how we stabilize people so they don't become homeless, or how we get them a series of services so that they will leave homelessness forever.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. You can learn more about growing homelessness in Seattle and our city's changing response to it at our website, KUOW.org. Just search homelessness. I'm Kim Malcolm. Thanks for joining us today on The Record on KUOW. Linda Hartzell never imagined a life was possible in the theater.
Never. I never thought anybody made a living by doing drama.
Hartzell was wrong. For more than 30 years, she's made her living as the artistic director of Seattle Children's Theater. Linda Hartzell will retire later this spring. Tomorrow, SCT opens the final play of her long tenure. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman looks back at Hartzell's legacy.
They call this the house that Linda built. It's the state-of-the-art home of the Seattle Children's Theater. This season, more than 100,000 kids and their families saw performances here at the Seattle Center. SCT presents 11 shows a week. 5 of them are school matinees. After every performance, the actors come out to answer questions.
How did I make my shoes really loud? I love that question. Thank you.
400 kids perch in their plush seats waiting for the answer. The Seattle Children's Theater wasn't always in these fancy digs. The company started life in 1971 in a building at the Woodland Park Zoo.
They rightfully would brag about the stage being strong enough to hold an elephant.
That's SCT Artistic Director Linda Hartzell. In 1993, she oversaw the company's move from the zoo. But her journey with the Seattle Children's Theater started long before that. Hartzell joined the company as an actor in 1977.
I was working an office job at Peter Pan Seafood. At that point, I was divorced and raising this little boy by myself. He was a couple of years old. And I went and auditioned, and I got cast.
7 years later, Hartzell was tapped to be SCT's interim artistic director. She never left. Linda Hartzell isn't one of those people who came up in the theater world. Her working-class family lived near Everett. Hartzell was the oldest child of an alcoholic, and life at home wasn't always easy. Movies, books, and music were Hartzell's escape.
It saved me as a kid. It saved me. I don't want to get maudlin. There are many wonderful times at home. There are many, many scary, sad times that I don't think children should have to experience.
Maybe that's why Hartzell is so driven to produce high-quality theater for young people. All the plays she produces have some kind of positive message, but that doesn't mean they're soft and squishy. Seattle Children's Theater productions feature professional adult actors and sets and costumes to rival any of Seattle's big theaters.
The mission of the theater, as Linda has envisioned it, is to do serious theater for young adults.
Kurt Beattie is Artistic Director Emeritus at Seattle's ACT Theater. SCT presented Beattie's adaptation of The Odyssey. The theater also has produced plays about the internment of Japanese Americans, the Nazi Holocaust. No topic is off limits. Beattie says Hartzell's artistic aspirations go beyond easy entertainment.
It's truly not about only about theatricals and about the magic of making it, but it's also about relating us to each other and the responsibilities that we have for each other. In that respect, she's done a very profound thing.
That sounds highfalutin, but SCT definitely has a lighter side.
When you're ready, put me down. Put me down,
said the fish.
Ice is no fun at all. Put me down,
said the fish.
I do not wish to fall.
Hartzell's last production as SCT Artistic Director is an adaptation of Dr. Seuss's classic The Cat in the Hat. She's always looking for that sweet spot between silly and ridiculous. Hartzell loves to hear her audiences laugh.
Every time I would start to get cynical, I would go in, and if it was a younger show, I'd hear their little voices laughing. And for me, I don't want to get religious, but if you believe in a higher power, you know there must be goodness and love when you hear a child laugh.
Hundreds of thousands of children have laughed and sometimes cried at Seattle Children's Theater during Hartzell's 32-year tenure. Under her leadership, SCT has provided subsidized tickets to every school show. Lisa Elliott teaches kindergarten at Seattle's Bailey Gatzert Elementary School. 100% of her students qualify for free and reduced-price meals. Their families can't afford to go to live theater, but scholarships will send Elliott's class to 3 SCT plays this year.
Most recently, we saw Where the Wild Things Are, which was particularly wonderful because the children actually sat on the stage and participated. They were wild things for about an hour.
Elliott says she doesn't have hard data, but she believes experiencing live theater translates into academic success for her students. It hasn't always been easy for SCT to subsidize school tickets or even to keep producing plays. The Great Recession hit the theater hard. Hartzell had to lay off staff and cut back on production expenses. Now that the economy has stabilized, Linda Hartzell says she can step down from this all-consuming work.
I want to sit for about 3 hours and read all the newspapers. I want to listen to an opera. I want to read a novel that's not a children's novel.
Hartzell has traveled around the world to talk about theater for young audiences. She's commissioned hundreds of plays and helped build a state-of-the-art facility, but it's the personal memories she cherishes the most. On her office wall is a frame drawing of the set of a play called Benicula. A little boy with learning challenges made it after he'd seen a performance.
The books on the bookcase are all the exact color. The detail is so specific that the parents called us up in tears and said, "We know he's bright. We know he's learning. We just know it. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you."
Linda Hartzell's final production as Seattle Children's Theater Artistic Director opens this weekend. Her replacement takes over in August. I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
After four decades resettling refugees in Western Washington, International Rescue Committee Executive Director Bob Johnson has stepped down. He's helped tens of thousands of refugees who have come to our region seeking safety after their lives were upended in other countries. Bob Johnson told KUOW's Bill Radke what the refugee community looked like in Seattle when he first started out.
I came up here in 1977, and there wasn't much for the refugee community yet. It just kind of started, mostly Vietnamese in those days, few Cambodians and a few Laotians. So it was a very small community. There were few Vietnamese that were here prior to the end of the war. So many of the new ones had kind of worked in with the existing community. And many people that lived through that period remember that Governor Dan Evans was the one that sort of said Washington State is going to jump into this, where Governor Brown in California said we don't want anything to do with it. So we had a group of Vietnamese that Governor Evans brought to Washington State, and then other refugees, mostly from Camp Pendleton in California, kind of followed. And so the agencies like International Rescue Committee kind of came in after the fact by about a year. And then we were kind of assigned to our refugees that had kind of come through us at Camp Pendleton but had moved to Washington State. And so we had a kind of a caseload that arrived before us, if you will.
And how have you seen that refugee picture change over the 40 years?
Well, it's actually changed, you know, almost every year to a certain extent. I mean, there are patterns we go through where new groups come in and then they'll be active for maybe 5-6 years and then they'll begin to fade out and a new group comes in. So I've been through them all, and we kind of phased into some of the first Ethiopians back in the late 80s or beginning of the 80s, and then we moved into sort of the end of the Cold War with the Eastern Europeans and some from the Soviet Union, and then we moved into the first group of Africans or larger groups like the Somalis, and then we, you know, Middle East refugees. We've had a new group now of Central Americans, and so it kind of phases in and out. Some come back, and I actually am surprised to see that, you know, we still get a few Vietnamese after all these years. And these are the new Vietnamese refugees. They're not really connected to the Vietnam War. They're sort of dissidents under the existing Vietnamese government. But we've had a few at International Rescue Committee in the last couple of years. And I think, you know, nationwide, there have been just a very few. And Seattle happens to be one of those places they've come.
You have talked to so many new refugees to the Puget Sound area. Have you noticed similarities in the first impressions of our area that they tell you about?
I think they're kind of pleasantly surprised, you know, by the sort of the beauty of the area. You know, they're mostly coming from, you know, difficult areas, you know, conflict zones, civil wars, long periods in refugee camps. And so they get here, and at least on a nice day, you know, it's going to be a very welcome experience. And then, you know, after a year or so and getting their feet on the ground, then refugees do start moving out into the same kind of activities that everybody else enjoys. I mean, I remember the Southeast Asians when they first came, all of a sudden they discovered, you know, coastal fishing and clamming and all of those things. It was sort of a natural thing because that was part of their diet where they came from. Many were fishermen. I've seen Bosnian refugees that have discovered fly fishing up in the mountains because that's something they did. I've seen a lot of, you know, volunteering with the Forest Service, I see all sorts of groups out there. And I've actually run into refugee groups hiking on our trails. So it takes a while. I mean, you know, you really have to get rooted first and get over the culture shock of just being here. But after a while, you look around and realize there's a lot of things to do.
We haven't much talked about you yet, Bob. What has it meant for you, resettling refugees here for 40 years?
Well, I know a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I, you know, they...
Your dinner parties are huge.
Yeah, and, you know, my experience with ethnic food is pretty wide. I've sampled just about everything. And, you know, the reward really comes from running into the children that arrived with the families back then that are now adults. And they are taking over many of the occupations. You see a lot of Vietnamese in professional positions, you know, doctors and lawyers and, you know, newspaper editorial columnists and that sort of thing. You see that same thing going on with the kids that graduate, you know, magna cum laude from college, going on to Harvard or something. And so, you know, I think overall, that's what I notice. It's not that I get attached to any particular family and stay in touch, you know, there's just too many. But many come back over the years and they'll walk in for an immigration service or some other reason and they'll say, oh, you're still here? And I think I sort of surprised them in that sense that, you know, 20 years later, they'll walk in and I'm still there. So I'm sure it's a bit of a shock now if they go in the office and I'm not there after all this time. But yeah, it's one of those I never thought I would be in any one occupation for a long period of time, you know. You know, I'm still volunteering with the International Rescue Committee one day a week, and so I'm not totally out of it yet, and actually working on a project in Montana with them too. So I think I'll probably stay in it for quite a while. It's sort of one of those things that you kind of gets in your blood and you really don't know any better and, you know, you want to keep going with it.
How many refugees would you say have been resettled in the Puget Sound area in the 40 years or so you've been at IRC?
Well, I don't know the total number. I think we've kept track mostly of our own, of International Rescue Committee, and we think we're at about 20,000 during that period of time. But that's, you know, when they arrived. You know, many refugees have children shortly after arrival. So if I had to kind of expand the number of generations from that 20,000, it's a pretty large number.
So you've affected a lot of people.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, hopefully positively. I mean, I think the Puget Sound area certainly benefited from that early resettlement. I mean, you think of all the businesses that refugees have started and taxes they're paying and wages they're earning and spending in their communities. You know, I think that there's been a very positive input to the community and to Washington State in general.
So you've helped shape the Puget Sound area. We're talking about tens or arguably hundreds of thousands of people when you think about the ripple effects. Where do you see yourself in that story?
Oh, I think I'm a very small part of that story. I mean, you know, my job has always been to help people get started. After that, it's up to them. So they've done the heavy lifting. I've just done kind of getting them in the door and getting them settled. And, you know, it's rewarding to me and hopefully it benefited them. But I think the fact that they've done the hard work is really what the credit should go to.
International Rescue Committee Executive Director Bob Johnson has stepped down after four decades settling refugees. He talked with Bill Radke.
I am the black sheep in my family. Scratch that. I'm actually more of a white sheep.
That's Kamna Shastri with our Radioactive Youth Media Program. She's trying to understand where she fits into conversations about race and identity. As she explains, her life has been shaped by the absence of color.
Here's what a family photo would look like. My mom and dad and brother, each with their own wonderful shade of brown. And then there's me. Pale, white, and blonde-haired. I was born with a genetic condition called albinism. You may have heard of the term albino. Basically, it results in a lack of pigment in my skin, hair, and eyes. So I blend easily into mainstream America. My parents emigrated to the U.S. from India. They never commented on how I looked. Home is the only place where I feel normal. It's only when I have to leave the comfort of immediate family that I get a really icky feeling. I feel out of place everywhere else, whether I'm in India, the U.S., or on Indian-American middle ground. In our Indian culture, fair skin tones are valued and seen as beautiful. But when I visit India, I am too fair to even fit the Indian standard of fairness. Those of us with albinism become foreigners in our own communities, and foreigners are often treated better than fellow Indians when visiting India. people are overly hospitable to me. They smile at me and provide extra help. They remind me that I am not one of them. When I speak in Tamil, their eyes grow wide with surprise. Some people bluntly question whether I'm really Indian. To me, that is painful. Now, when I'm in the United States, I gain a lot of privileges since I pass so easily as white. I can find eyebrow pencils that are the color I need, while my mom struggles to find makeup that fits her skin tone. I don't get empty soda cans thrown at me from a passing car where the driver calls out racial slurs. Unfortunately, this has happened one too many times to my friends who are people of color. I unintentionally benefit from this privilege. But in the process, my ethnicity becomes invisible. This is especially challenging when I want to interact with other Indian Americans. People see my blonde hair, but they'll never guess that afternoon chai is the most important part of my day. As soon as I walk into a temple, my fists clench and my shoulders tighten. I am afraid of being left out when the community I so want to be a part of doesn't see me as one of their own. I've lived my whole life thinking that someday I'll look more like my parents, that albinism will just disappear. But that's an impossible fantasy. I'm always going to struggle to accept myself for who I am and how I look. Images of people like Mindy Kaling and Nina Davuluri will continue to remind me of all I want but can't have. Still, every night when I go to bed, I look up at the ceiling and think, "Thank you, albinism." So, my dear albinism, as much as you irk me, you have gifted me a wider view of the world. You've let me experience what it's like to fit in while also having to deal with standing out. You've taught me that first impressions are inherently judgmental. You've shown me that there is something way more important than being accepted by people who don't know me, and that is to value the people who know me beyond the superficial. Your most valuable lesson, though, has taught me that I need to define myself on my own terms. I'm done with letting my complexion and what people say about it decide who I am and where I belong in the world. For Radioactive, I'm Kamna Shastri.
Radioactive is KUOW's youth program. Applications are now open for our summer radio journalism workshop. Youth ages 16 to 18 can apply at kuow.org/radioactive. You still have some time to get your application in. The deadline to apply is Monday, April 25th. I'm Kim Malcolm. Thanks for joining us this afternoon on The Record on KUOW. 2 weeks ago, Marta Martinez and Karina Morales Rodriguez were shot dead in downtown Yakima. Then, before the central Washington city could grieve those deaths, three more people were shot and killed in gang and drug-related disputes this past weekend. All of this has people in Yakima asking how to prevent more gun deaths. Carmen Mendez is a newly elected member of the Yakima City Council and executive director of the Safe Yakima Valley Coalition. And tonight, she's holding a citywide listening session to discuss that question and hopefully come up with some community-centered answers. Carmen Mendez told me she was on a police ride-along when she heard about the most recent shootings.
When the first shooting was called in and all of a sudden the computer was going crazy and I asked Officer Quinones, what's going on? He said, this is our priority call. There's just been a shooting.
And what did you think when you heard about it?
I was afraid. For a moment, I thought he was, you know, he had to go drop me off. But it happened 2 blocks away from where I live. And within a few hours, we received another email about the next incident and so on. And I think there's a lot of fear, not only fear that I felt for myself, but a lot of fear in our community and troublesome for all of us that we're living here and have kids and having to work here. It's just a tough time for our county.
Carmen, would it be fair to say that people are still trying to process how to respond to this?
Absolutely. I myself am not quite sure how to handle everything that's happening, and this is why we need to be able to hear from the rest of the community. And to be completely honest, I think we're still grieving about it as a community. The fact that 5 deaths happened within a 2-week period is unheard of for Yakima, and they're all unrelated. And so it's really tragic, and because of that, we need to be able to start having conversations with the community as a whole.
Are you seeing any signs of hope, or is that too soon to say?
I think that would be too soon to say. It's been less than a week, and I don't know how we're going to come out of this.
And you're holding a citywide listening session tonight to talk about these shootings. So what solutions are you hoping are going to come out of it?
You know, hopefully we have an opportunity to hear from residents about some of the things that they're worried about, but also to hear from county agencies and citywide agencies about what is currently being done and how can we help as a community to address these issues.
So how do you know the way to solve this problem isn't through city government or police, but through Yakima residents having these conversations about the killings at home?
I think that the sheriff's department or the police department aren't the only ones responsible for community safety. I think that community safety is every resident's responsibility, being watchful, knowing your neighbors. And I think that even though the community is still grieving, it's an opportunity to come together and talk about some of the root causes as to why these young men are doing these sort of things and how do we prevent our future generations from having that sort of future.
Carmen Mendez is a Yakima City councilwoman. She's also the executive director of Safe Yakima Valley. Tonight, she's holding a community-wide meeting to try to figure out how to reduce gun violence in Yakima. On Saturday, music lovers will line up outside independent music stores for Record Store Day. It's an event that started 9 years ago by record stores, with a special emphasis on buying actual vinyl records. The thing is, Seattle never really needed something like Record Store Day. We've been a city of vinyl consumers for years. Martin Fevier is a music producer and mixer for Jupiter Recording Studio in Seattle. He told me why he thinks Seattle loves records so much.
It is a town that's used to making its own decisions about many things in life. And one of those is the kind of music that it listens to and buys. I don't think it gets dictated by the mainstream media so much. So it's used to taking chances on new music. And a lot of people do that through vinyl.
What's the secret there? Why do people keep buying records on vinyl?
For me, it feels kind of obvious. We live in a world where music kind of now appears anonymously from many, many sources. It falls out of the sky, but usually it's faceless or it comes with a small image on your phone or on your screen. I think when you have vinyl, it's a much more physical thing that, you know, you're connected to it more. There's usually some kind of packaging that you can read and get attached to. There's more information that comes with it. It's a very physical thing. You get to own it. You get to have it in your hands while you're listening to it. I think you just get connected to it more.
And I know people have very strong opinions about how it sounds. You're one of those people, I think.
No, actually not. I mean, it sounds different from other mediums, and people always say it sounds warmer. I can give you technical reasons why kind of that's not true. What it does sound is different, and it has a limited bandwidth. It usually has a filtered low end, less low end. It usually has less high end than, say, a digital medium. But what it does have is distortion, which is, as animals, we love it. It's exciting and adds musicality. So I think we connect to it more. You know, getting back to the physical side of things, not only are you holding something physical in your hands or you have something to show for the money you've spent, but the process of getting that sound from the groove, through the needle, through the speakers, is a mechanical and physical process. It's not a digital one. And I think we react to that, and the inherent distortion that comes with that, although it sometimes is subtle, we react to it, respond to it, and we love it.
When you're working with a band or a musician, how do you help them decide whether or not to record on vinyl?
In an age where more people have more music on their phones and they're listening to more music than ever, they're generally not paying for it. So when an artist makes a record, they know they're not really getting any money back. They're not going to generate their money to take care of the cost of the recording anymore. So with vinyl, it at least gives them something. You know, a record marks a statement in time of their performance and their artistry. And having a physical vinyl record to show for that is lasting for them.
Let's leap to the future now. As the music industry continues to change, do you think vinyl is going to continue to find an audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the fastest growing sector in the music industry. You know, those little companies that managed to keep their pressing plants open during the rough years of the 90s and early 2000s are now flourishing. They are very glad that they kept their machines running, and you know, they're having problems finding enough vinyl, because there is a need when you buy something. There is a human need to have something to kind of, you know, show for that, I think. And those that truly love music and are interested in new music are willing to put their money where their mouth is and spend their time and their money getting something that has a shelf life.
Martin Fevier is a producer and mixer for Jupiter Records in Seattle. His favorite record? Hunky Dory by David Bowie. This Saturday, 25 stores in Seattle and many more around the Puget Sound area will participate in Record Store Day.
Pretinho tem uma proposta decorosa pra te fazer. Quero que você venha comigo, nega, pra você ver.